my place in tech changes every day. But I don't fear the future, because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts, so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Lost in the fog of a cosmic storm, floating on whims of the wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light, riding the waves that are just out of sight.
Welcome back to Whimsical Wavelengths. I'm your host with the most bad puns, jokes. Well, anyway, today is no different. I'm Dr. Jeffrey Zurich, a volcanologist and your guide to riding some whimsical wavelengths. This episode is all about old events and how they may still directly affect us today. Much older than the expiration date on a Twinkie, we're going all the way back to the age of the dinosaurs. Hey, why didn't the dinosaur cross the road? Well, it's because the chicken hadn't evolved yet. The age of the dinosaurs, or the Mesozoic era, took place between around 252 to 66 million years ago. The end of the Mesozoic era was an extinction event, or events, that took out the dinosaurs. Yeah, and piecing together that extinction event and how what led up to it and everything else and telling that whole story, we'll have to wait. It'll have to join the ever-growing list of episode ideas. See, our branch of the animal kingdom, mammals, first evolved around 200 million years ago, during the age of dinosaurs. The first fossil record of a mammal was dated to approximately 205 million years ago, and was like a shrew or some other like creature. Over the next nearly 150 million years, mammals were small, and dinosaurs ruled the Earth. Perhaps we shouldn't say that they ruled the Earth, because clearly that gives them too much credit for administrative skills they didn't have. So, our whimsical topic today is to explore why we have the lifespan we do, and evolution perhaps more generally. This topic comes from a hypothesis published in BioEssays, the article called The Longevity Bottleneck Hypothesis. Could dinosaurs have shaped aging in present-day mammals? By João Pedro Magalhães. The premise, to quote the paper directly, long evolutionary pressure on early mammals for rapid reproduction led to the loss or inactivation of genes and pathways associated with long life. Basically, dinos were big, scary, and really good at eating mammals. Therefore, there was an evolutionary pressure for rapid reproduction and no reason or pressure to develop or use genes for DNA repair or other processes that slow aging. See, this is a crazy fun topic to get into. By fun topic, clearly, I'm also fun at parties. Honestly, this is going to be so much fun to get into. However, I need to make a confession first. Way back when I decided on the best way to study volcanoes, I chose the physics and geology route for one reason. I cannot spell. I've gotten better through practice and master's and PhD. You know, your theses are like a book, but I am still terrible. Thank goodness for modern technology and spell check. Well, in my high school, you would lose marks for getting the spelling of names wrong in biology. So I desperately wanted to avoid that. By the way, do you know what a bad grade in biology is called? Biodegraded. Look, no amount of general knowledge can really overcome what I lack for this discussion, because I didn't take biology. So thankfully, Dr. Molly Burke, an evolutionary biologist, has agreed to help us explore this topic.
So
Dr. Molly Burke is an associate professor in the Department of Integrated Biology at Oregon State University. She got her PhD conducting experimental research into evolutionary biology. One of the papers I attempted to understand in preparation for this episode was published in the prestigious Journal of Nature in 2010. It used fruit flies to explore how organisms pass on genes and respond to beneficial mutations. The Burke Lab at Oregon State University uses model organisms to explore a number of evolutionary processes, including aging. So, listeners, please welcome Dr. Molly K. Burke.
Thanks for having me.
So when I stumbled across this idea, I knew I wanted to do an episode on it, and I needed an expert to explore it, because as stated in the intro, I don't know much about genetics or biology in general. So one of the hardest questions, especially for a lot of researchers, is how would you describe your research to the general public?
Sure. Well, I usually describe my research as that I get to watch evolution happen in real time. So if you think about it, evolution is really hard to study because we can't go back in time, right? And maybe, you know, there's probably some similarities to geology there. So we could look at the fossil record or things like ancient DNA, but that's still like a really big challenge for lots of reasons. So in evolution, we're kind of limited to making comparisons among things that live today and trying to infer what happened in the past to make them the way they are. But that's really speculative. So there are a subset of us in this line of work who take a different approach, and it's called experimental evolution. So in experimental evolution, the idea is that in the lab, we can force populations of organisms to evolve and observe that evolution in real time. And that's what we do in my lab. So my specific research makes use of some of the best studied organisms that we have in genetics, so fruit flies and research, and we can subject them to stressful or novel environments that we come up with, and we can study them over time, looking at their physical traits and their DNA, and try to figure out why they evolved that way. And so this is a really experimentally powerful approach, and it can't really help us understand what happened in the past, but it can help us predict what might happen in the future, given a certain set of circumstances. So in my lab, we study lots of different traits in this way, but we do have a special focus on aging and longevity.
Awesome. I'll come back to the whole trying to predict the past in a little bit, but I think to get to where we need to go, perhaps there's some background terms or ideas we should talk about first. Remember, feel free to add new terms or anything as you feel it needs to help the understanding of the stated hypothesis, but I think perhaps we should start with what evolutionary pressure means.
Yeah, that's a question that different evolutionary biologists might give you different answers to. But in this context, we're talking about selective pressure. So in other words, natural selection, right? And natural selection imposing pressure that leads to the prioritization of individuals with traits that maximize reproduction and survival. But to be fair, there are other evolutionary forces out there too, like random chance.
Okay. Deviation, stage left. What is how important is random chance?
Yeah, and I mean, I guess to define a new term, so usually when we're talking about random chance and evolution, we call that genetic drift. And it is really impactful. Organisms can, you know, have really big changes affect them for generations to come just by chance. And so I like to think of selection as the sort of the way that we come to evolution first, right? It's the force that we think about first and foremost, but its path is often influenced by things like random chance.
I see. So our genes, they are sequences of DNA representing a basic unit of hereditary, a garble of words that I think mean that in the case of mammals that the DNA and the genes are what's passed down from parent to child. Is that kind of like the simplest way to describe them?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Genes are usually thought of as the units of heredity because they make proteins, and proteins are what shape our traits as individuals. Like proteins can take the form of enzymes that catalyze biochemical reactions, or they can also proteins are also structural components of our cells that help maintain their integrity. So the health of our genes leads to the health, you know, leads to healthy anatomy and physiology. But from my vantage point, I think it's actually more accurate to consider the DNA sequence. So whether you have an A, G, C, or T at a location in your genome as the most basic unit of heredity. And there's lots of DNA that occurs outside of genes. And it's harder to connect variation there to our traits, but it doesn't mean that it can't. So you might have a mutation outside of a gene that affects a gene's expression, like how much protein that gene makes. And that mutation could be considered evolutionarily relevant in addition to the DNA sequence of the gene itself.
Just to add on, you mentioned the different letters of DNA there. I've forgotten or don't know. What do those letters specifically stand for?
Oh, okay. Pop quiz. Adenine, cytosine, thymine, and guanine. So those are the four nucleotide bases that can make up the molecule of DNA. And so, right, so there's only four letters that make up the 3 billion base pairs in our human genome. And and only a very small proportion of our genome is actually made up of genes. So it does make sense to think about genes first, but most of the DNA in our genome doesn't encode for any genes at all.
Right. Okay, so with genes and DNA roughly defined, like all scientific methods, we have to test ideas to explore different questions, including evolution. So you've already alluded that you use fruit flies, and I guess they are what you would be called a model organism. So is there any others that your lab uses, and specifically, why would you use them?
Yeah, so model organisms are the ones that are really easy and convenient to work with in the lab so that we can use them to test ideas that should apply to a lot of species. So fruit flies are an especially popular model organism for genetics research. Geneticists were studying them before we even knew what DNA was.
And really?
Yeah,
like how?
Yeah.
Well, in which way? Because
you can see their chromosomes under a microscope. So as soon as we figured out what chromosomes were, fruit flies became a popular model. And also it's just really easy. Well, the main reason why model organisms are model organisms is because it's easy to keep them in a lab setting. They have fast generations. They have traits that are easy to score. They're cheap to take care of, things like that. But yeast are another model organism in genetics research, a really popular one. And my lab uses it mostly these days, mostly yeast and sometimes fruit flies. And yeast are even better at some of those model organism traits because they divide. So a fruit fly will a fruit fly generation is something like 2 weeks in a lab. But for a yeast, if it's happy, it can divide in 90 minutes. So we can get a lot of generations and a lot of evolutionary time in a short amount of real time.
So these model organisms, use them like fruit flies and yeast because you're exploring the evolutionary processes. You obviously need many generations to study how they genetically change. So just as a follow-up, how many generations are we talking about for one study or experiment?
Oh, yeah. So like for with fruit flies, if they have a 2 week generation time, you could imagine accumulating a couple of dozen generations in a year, depending on the kind of selection pressure you're applying, of course. And then with yeast, we can evolve populations of yeast for hundreds of generations in a matter of weeks. So it becomes much easier to think about long-term evolution experiments when you're working with something like a microbe.
For sure. So I would gather, what's the best way to say this? A yeast would be a better tool for, say, a master's student who only has 2 years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll put it this way. When I was getting my PhD, I worked in a fruit fly lab. And when I became a postdoc, one of my goals was to figure out how to switch organisms so that I could do experiments faster. It just everything becomes a little bit easier when you can do these experiments on a shorter time frame.
Right. But there's obviously some benefits to being able to use the fruit flies over the yeast, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course. I mean, I struggle sometimes to get people excited about yeast. I mean, they're cool. They allow us to have beer and stuff like that. But, as far as the traits you can measure in them, they're a single celled organism. So they're, by contrast, something like a fruit fly is exciting because they have like eye colors that you can score and, you know, body colors, stripe patterns, number of antennae, things like that.
Don't go overboard. This is your chance to really talk about the yeast.
Yeah. Well, there are a surprising number of traits we can measure in yeast. I'll say that.
Yeah. Well, if we were judging by people we meet everywhere on the street, we have different hair color, skin color, eye color. There's a lot of different genetic possibilities just visually. So what goes into picking a starting population of model organisms? I mean, is like there's a starting genetics that might bias the results, so you have to be careful of that, or is there, do you want a starting genetics to be all similar or maximize diversity, or like, how do you go about designing that test population?
Yeah, I love this question. That's a pretty, I think, that's a tricky question. So I would say there's a bit of a divide, I guess, between those of us who do this kind of work, doing the watching evolution in real time, or at least two ways of thinking about this. On one hand, you might want to start with a population that has, where all the individuals have exactly the same genetics, right? Where everyone is exactly the same. And that's easy to do if you're using a microbe like a bacterium. If all cells that you start with are clones of one another, and then you apply some kind of selection pressure, that leads to, you know, adaptive mutations that are easy to identify and characterize in evolved populations. In other words, it's a simple setup that can essentially prove the adaptive value of a given mutation, right? But there's another perspective to think about. If you want to predict like how contemporary populations of a species like humans might evolve in the future, we probably shouldn't do it that way, right? What we should do is start with an ancestor population that's intentionally designed to be diverse or mimic what we might think is the amount of diversity in like a human population. The changes that might affect that population as it evolves could involve lots of subtle changes at lots of different places in the genome. And those are going to be harder to detect and understand. But potentially that's going to be more relevant to the populations that we think about, that we care about managing, or humans are thinking about ourselves, you know?
Right.
But both perspectives I think are really valuable and useful. So in my lab, just to be clear, we take the latter approach. So we intentionally start with mixed up populations where there's lots of genetic diversity and we, watch how they evolve.
Okay, so before we pivot to aging and longevity, what are some of the questions besides aging and longevity that you and your lab study today?
Yeah, well, we do a lot of different things. I'm lucky, you know, I have a bunch of students working with me and they all have really different interests. So we're studying the evolution of antimicrobial drug resistance, antifungal drug resistance in particular. We are studying the evolution of multicellularity, because one of the cool things about yeast is that they have certain genetic switches that they can flip to stay unicellular or take on a more multicellular form. So we're trying to learn a little bit more about that. And we're also just thinking about climate change a lot these days. So trying to use yeast as a model for how populations might respond to fluctuations in stresses like thermal stresses.
Awesome. Now, just before we get back to the whole aging question, obviously we as humans have a direct stake in understanding aging because that's what happened to us as we get older. And I thought we could take a bit of a short interlude or break from the heavy science talk and do something incredibly silly. Detour to snake oil. I mean, anti-aging ideas are not necessarily based on science, and there's quite a few of them. So I assume, do you know of any yourself that might be, if not, I have a handful and okay. We'll just kind of go through them and get back to our regularly scheduled program.
Yeah. Why don't you start us off?
Sure. One of the themes is all about blood. Transfusion or drinking of blood has been thought of as a rejuvenation method since the ancient times. Parabosis, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, is the procedure of joining two animals so they share each other's blood circulation. Now, this has sort of seen a revitalization in the concept as a drug. They've shown that it kind of sort of works on mice, but it really brings up the whole idea of vampires.
Good topic for Halloween.
Yeah, I mean, this will be coming out after Halloween. But that's okay. That's a timestamp for anybody listening. Whole body cryotherapy. Yeah, getting into a chamber briefly at minus 125 degrees Celsius, or for those south of the border, below minus 200 Fahrenheit. The Federal Drug Administration is concerned that people using this may injure themselves, have no improvement or worsening of their medical conditions, and develop a new medical problem. I think I've also seen this on, I didn't actually watch the episode, but the commercial for the episode, CSI, somebody froze themselves to death in one of these chambers, and then it was a whodunit.
Yeah, I've seen one of those in real life, I have to say.
Did you try it?
No, but I was at a fundraising event for one of these companies that provides this service for either freezing your head or your whole body.
Ah, yeah, I still find it very, very strange. Going back into time, Chinese alchemical elixirs. Somewhere around 400 BCE, the practice of making elixirs of immortality from metallic and mineral substances. The problem was, because it's metallic substances, they sometimes led to heavy metal poisoning, which obviously did the opposite of what they were trying to do. Leeches have been used throughout history for different medical conditions. They're parasitic worms that suck your blood. It can also then be taken from the leech afterwards to put it into a cream to put back on your skin, which seems really creepy. There really is a lot of blood themes out there when I was looking these things up. The most crazy one, which I think might be a bit of a rumor, given the fact it was so old ago in power dynamics of the ancient world, Cleopatra supposedly took a daily bath in milk supplied by a herd of 700 lactating donkeys.
I'll have to try that one.
The point is that we've been fascinated with aging and prolonging life for a long period of time. It's just kind of in our nature, for sure. So to return to our regularly scheduled program, we all know what it feels like to age, but what does it mean scientifically, really?
Yeah, I guess in my world, we tend to use the term senescence when we're talking about aging, and senescence specifically means a decline in physiology that's associated with increased age. So senescence is how our bodies break down and lead to decreased reproduction and survival as we age.
In preparation, I also came across a Weissman's panmixa. Is that how you pronounce that? Theory.
Panmixia? Let me see.
There we go. Actually, to be fair, you passed me this paper, which seems to have given risen to perhaps the stated hypothesis, or maybe I'm being too simplistic. To spell it out, traits useless to an organism are not acted on by natural selection, and therefore eventually disappear on their own. In this particular case, the dinosaur hypothesis states the loss or inactivation of genes and pathways associated with long life were lost because they were not required. So is that kind of summing up? Is that kind of part and parcel with that idea?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that logic makes sense. Usually, you know, when I try to explain this idea of the evolutionary theory of aging, I like to think about it the other way, right? It's not about losing longevity, it's about gaining it. So this is what I, you know, studied, why I'm a scientist today, actually, is because I learned about this concept and I thought it was so fascinating. And the concept is just that natural selection is really primed to keep us healthy and robust until we start to reproduce. Right. And that makes sense. That's how evolution by natural selection works. You have to reproduce in order for your genes to get passed on, and you have to be alive to reproduce. The idea is that that age of reproduction is a pretty key parameter in that process. And so if you were to, for example, postpone that age, by, say, preventing all of the individuals in a population from reproducing until they were older, what that would do is over time, it would lead to a population of organisms that have to stay healthy longer so that they can reproduce, and therefore, as a side effect, live longer. And so this idea is that natural selection can be tuned, I'll flip it around. Longevity can be tuned by natural selection, and that can go either way. It could be manipulated to lead to longer lived individuals, and in the case of this article, potentially shorter lived individuals.
Okay, bit of a exit stage left again. Perhaps the question, my question is like, we see as a population scale dynamics that we humans today are having kids later and later and later. Is that potentially also prolonging our life?
Yeah, I'd love that. You know, I had my first baby at 37. So it's tempting to think like that, right? So that is the way the logic works. The problem, so to speak, is that that will only work if every single individual in this case, the human species, were to delay their reproduction, right? As soon as you have variation in the population and some individuals are reproducing earlier, that's going to wash out that signal of some of the individuals who are reproducing later, because they'll have more babies, right, in theory, or their genes will be passed on in a more exponential fashion if they're reproducing earlier. So yes, you're right, but that would only work if, say, there was some super morally problematic law that were passed down that said you had to reach age X before you had your first baby.
And I would imagine it would also take a significant amount of time to really start to see that also, even if that were the case.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. Although, so this concept has been demonstrated in the lab with fruit flies, most famously, but in other organisms too. So in fruit flies, it only took about a dozen generations to see big shifts in longevity. So in fruit flies, you can do this in a morally unproblematic way, right? You simply just, fruit flies lay their eggs on the food that they eat. And so you can just throw out the eggs laid by young individuals and only allow the eggs that are laid by older individuals to found the next generation, right? So in the lab, using this technique of experimental evolution and a model organism like fruit flies, you can create populations of fruit flies that live, you know, 2, 3, 4 times longer than what you started with within a matter of, say, 10 generations.
That's astounding. I was not expecting that answer at all.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, right? That's why this is such a cool theory, because it's really backed up by some solid evidence. So in humans, I guess, I don't know how long it would take, but what I'm suggesting is it might not take as long as you would expect if everyone were following the rules, so to speak.
Right. And by everyone would expect, again, we're talking scientifically, not necessarily on a geologic time scale, but certainly longer than a human life. So given the time that it takes so many organisms and DNA to change in a controlled environment, as I just alluded to, it's not exactly something we can do in our own lifespans. So how can we, I mean, you've kind of already just kind of explained my next question, but is there any other way to get at using model organisms to look at aging in humans that we haven't missed?
Well, I mean, I think that the more traditional way to study aging and make connections to humans is to think about individual mutations, right? And to think about a mutation or a gene, you know, that might have some link to longevity in humans. And because, you know, organisms share so much of our DNA blueprint, a lot of those genes have orthologs in other species, like fruit flies. So you could take a gene in a human, look at that same gene, the fruit fly version of it, and make a mutation in it and see does the fruit fly live longer, right? Or do the descendants of that fruit fly live longer because of that mutation? The challenge, I think, in studying aging that way is that you have to look at one mutation or one gene at a time. And the reason why I think it's so much more valuable to take an evolutionary perspective and use this foundation of the evolutionary theory of aging is that in theory, you can study changes in the whole genome at once, right? You don't have to just go one gene or one mutation at a time.
And just real quick, you used the word ortholog?
Oh, yes. So that just means a gene that has the same sequence in two species, presumably because of they share ancestry at some point. If a gene in a fruit fly has a human ortholog, it means it has a very, very similar sequence and it makes a very similar protein. So that means that you should be able to mess with that gene in a fruit fly and expect that you would see whatever consequences that has for the fruit fly could be reasonably extended to what would happen in a human.
Okay, so we've roughly laid out, hopefully, what it means to try to study genetics and aging in the lab. Is there any way to actually test the hypothesis that is about the dinosaurs providing that evolutionary pressure that just wanted us to keep producing babies instead of having a longer life? So can we blame the dinosaurs for affecting our lifespan over, even though they've been gone 66 million years? And if we can't right now, where do we need to get before we can start to try to test that? Because, I mean, there's lots of examples in science where it took decades before we could test, gravitational waves being one of the famous examples.
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, I guess. I mean, I think this hypothesis is so fascinating, right? Because it gets us to think about why we are the way we are due to something that happened in deep evolutionary time. As far as testing the hypothesis, I think that the best hypothesis test mechanism we have is this experimental evolution idea, right? I mean, and in the lab, not only has it been shown over and over again that you can extend lifespan by altering this age of reproduction, but you can also curtail it too. You can also move the other way. So there are lots of experiments in fruit flies and other organisms where you go the opposite direction and you only allow the fastest developing, first to reproduce individuals to pass on their genes. And as a result, you get kind of this live fast, die young phenotype or traits, set of traits. And so you can manipulate longevity in the direction of reduced longevity too. So how could you actually test that with the dinosaurs and these ideas presented in the article? I'm not sure you can directly, but we can point to, this idea that you can manipulate aging experimentally in the lab and it works. And so that lends some credibility to the idea. You can also point to many studies of aging that look at, they either go out and compare similar populations, meaning populations of the same species that differ in their extrinsic mortality rate. By that, I mean the kind of mortality that's imposed by predation, right? And so there's a famous group of experiments on the Virginia possum, where there's a mainland group and an island group. And the island group lives way longer than the mainland group because of that reduced extrinsic mortality rate. They don't have the same predators on the island that the mainland possums have to deal with. And so there are lots of examples of things like that aren't exactly a direct hypothesis test. So bats live longer than most mammals, even when you correct for metabolic rate and things like that. And it's because we think that they can fly and therefore their extrinsic mortality rate is lower than mammals that can't fly, right? So same size mammals, bats and a similarly sized rodent, let's say bats live way longer. And we think that's most likely because of this reduction in extrinsic mortality. So all of these examples that I'm pointing to are really potentially supportive of the idea here, but not direct hypothesis tests. So I can't really think of a perfect hypothesis test, but I do think that lots of lines of evidence are supportive of it.
It's just strikes me amazing that no matter what field, no matter how esoteric it may sound at the beginning, there's always connections to different things. Like, who thought the genetics of a fruit fly would lead to a connection with dinosaurs and mammals, for instance? So right. It seems like you never know where the next scientific discussion or discovery is going to take you. And I know we're not here in a rigorous way at the moment, but in general, what do you think about the hypothesis? And are there any issues that should have been given more thought before put into their discussion or conclusion or description?
Well, I like big sort of bombastic ideas like this. So I think that I think it was a cool piece to read. I like the argument. I think, like I said, it's well reasoned. One thing that strikes me as, you know, what I have questions about is this idea that maybe these repair mechanisms or mechanisms that promote longevity were completely lost. You know, that's something that I think bears a little more scrutiny, in the sense that the dinosaurs have been gone for a long time. There's been a huge proliferation of mammals since then. And a lot of these predation pressures have been gone for a long time. So does it, I don't know, I guess I just would wonder why haven't we bounced back, right? It would, presumably—
With respect to longevity.
With respect to longevity, yeah. Presumably because those mechanisms were completely lost in the population. And I have a hard time seeing how natural selection alone would lead to that outcome. But I alluded to earlier this idea of random chance and genetic drift. I do think that perhaps those mechanisms could have been lost through a combination of drift and selection, and therefore just not be available anymore for natural selection to promote.
All right, we've come to the last question, the one I make every single person do. Sadly, my uncle couldn't come up with a joke on the last interview. That's okay. So it's a tradition here that I've started at Whimsical Wavelengths. What is your favorite science joke?
Well, I hate to disappoint you. I couldn't think of a joke either. But I do have, it's not a joke, but I do think of this quote that I think is ascribed to Isaac Asimov. And it's the most exciting phrase to hear in science, the one that heralds new discoveries, is not eureka, but that's funny. So not a joke exactly, but I think about that all the time. And it's so true. And that's sort of the one phrase that you want your grad student to come in and share with you. Like, you don't really want them to say eureka. You want them to say, you know, I noticed this funny thing.
Yeah, you want them to be confused. Think it means something? They found something they didn't expect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what I got.
Awesome. Well, that brings the interview to a close, unless you remember something that you want to add or anything.
I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think so. I appreciate you reaching out and wanting to chat about this nerdy stuff and the evolution of aging. I always am surprised by how I don't want to say unpopular, but it surprises me how this evolutionary theory of aging, not a lot of people know about it, right? And so I'm happy to tell you more about it and give you my take.
Awesome.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that discussion. I know I did, and I definitely learned a lot. This is only my third interview, and I hope there are many, many more to come. But I need your feedback. I need to know what topics I should do. If there's something I need to change, then I need to change it. But I need you to tell me that. Thankfully, I do have a couple of friends that are giving me constant feedback, but the reality is there's so many more people that listen to it. Also, a special thanks to those Patreons. I do have a Patreon account. That is one way you can help this keep moving on and keep getting new guests and new topics to whimsically detach from everyday life for just a little while. As part of being a Patreon, you'll also get access to a Discord server for just asking me more questions, as well as, if I don't know the answer, maybe I find someone that can do it properly as part of an episode. And if all that isn't for you and you still like the podcast, remember, subscribe, leave a rating, tell a friend, because that's how this podcast keeps going.
Lost in the fog of a cosmic storm, floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light. Riding the waves that are just out of sight. In a world so so chaotic that misbehaves. Melodies that echo show us six always. Colors intertwine, painting the sky. We're lost in the rhythm as the universe flies by. Oh, we're tuned in, feeling the beat of the unknown. Can you hear it? It's echoing through your bones. In this melodic maze, we let our